Hello. I think hopefully you can all hear me now, and they can all hear you now. Fingers crossed that now works better.
Okay. Should we try?
Take a deep breath.
Take a deep breath, everyone. Oh, this is so traumatic. Shall we start over?
I think start over.
Let's just start over. Let's pretend like nothing happened, and like when it actually comes to the podcast, I'll edit it out. No one will even know. It's fine. Oh, right.
Unless they watch the stream.
Shh. Disable. Shh. Right. I'm gonna start. Right. Gameplay. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the fifth and Oh god, I'm bollocked.
Wow.
Such pressure.
Wow.
Well, people in the chat at least are saying that they can hear us now, which is thank God for that.
Awesome.
Right. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the sixth and final episode of Paleo Party Season 2. We've had a lot of technical difficulties, but we're finally back. So, where was I? Yes, thank you very much to the Paleontological Society. Big thanks to them for funding this season and funding our work. We really appreciate the support that they've given us. As always, I'm joined by the wonderful Emma and Chris and everyone here on chat. Hello, everyone in chat. Sorry about the delay. And we have a very special guest this evening. She's a data scientist who works in paleontology and is the proud mother of cats. It's Naseeba Raja, everyone! Woohoo!
Right, so we're asking all of our guests to attempt to explain what they do using the Opcor 5 text editor, which only allows you to use the most common words, 1,000 most common words in the English language to explain something. This is particularly tricky, seeing as neither paleontology nor fossil appear amongst these words. However, I think, Naseeba, you might have nailed it. Would you like to take it away?
Oh, okay. So imagine putting your hand in very hot water for 1 minute. It hurts. Now, imagine putting your hand in very hot water for weeks on end. It's not very nice and you might die. The same is happening to many living things at the moment because the world is getting hotter. This is nothing new. This has happened many, many, many years ago. Even before there were humans, some living things died and some didn't. I use computers to understand why some things died and some didn't. And what is the difference about those that didn't? This will maybe help save many living things, but not until humans stop making the world hotter.
Ooh, that was very good.
I guess you might work on climate change.
Very correct.
I like the idea of, like, you put your hand in hot water and it's not very nice. It's like, no. Depends how hot it is.
That's how it went from it's not very nice or it hurts to you might die.
Yeah, you might die. Yeah.
Well, it escalates quite a bit, right?
Like the without frog, the sit in the pot of the water. Same vibes.
I think all I could think about was in that moment. I was just like, "What do you call it if you put a frog in really hot water?" Disgusting tea. Okay, let's move on.
As you're all very much aware, it is a live show tonight. We're on Twitch live. So please send us in any questions you have for Naseeba or for us, for anything about anything you wish, about anything paleontological related or anything. Yeah, just anything, really. And we'll continue with this chaotic sixth episode.
Yeah, this is the height of professionalism right now. It's absolutely gone to pot. Let's just stop pretending. Let's stop pretending it's even like on track.
Oh, I'm fine with this. I think let's just roll with it.
Down to Naseeba to get us back on track.
Yes, Naseeba, help us. Save us.
Would you like to explain your research or your what you do without being restricted by Opcor 5?
Well, these days, what I do is basically what I said in the Opcor 5. So I work on corals, well, technically reef builders, because I work on all reef builders, which means sponges, corals, supposedly microbial carbonates, when I figure out what those are, and like other encrusters, such as red algae, you have the bivalves, whatever, anything that you anything that you can find in a reef, but not that live in a reef, but actually make the reef itself. So this 3D structure. And what I look at is basically other geological record, because we have a record of like reefs throughout the Phanerozoic, which is the last 540 million years. And basically what made them successful, what made them die. So far we've been focusing on why they die. And then we kind of like in the last month decided to look at why they are successful, which is quite good, I think. Like we focus too much on the negativity, but to do that, I basically use data that has been collected by other paleontologists. So I don't go out in the field myself because I wouldn't know what to do. But I do know what to do with the data, and I analyze this to basically see whether there were any like patterns in terms of like reef booms, as we call them, during the successful times. What's the opposite of booms?
Bust.
Yeah, there we go. And when they die, basically. So that's what I do. Yeah, that's about it.
So what, I've got so many questions. And the first question is, what is a reef? And what makes a reef different from just a couple of creatures and organisms living on the seabed?
Very good question.
Thank you very much. I pride myself on my skill. Thank you.
So there are many definitions of reefs. And what we go with usually is anything that is 3D and built by, made of limestone, basically. And for me, anything that is like 3D and made of limestone is a reef. So you do have like differences now between like true reefs and whatever. I don't really care about these. Anything for me is a reef, like as soon as like it builds some sort of structure at this point.
So it's just a structure in the ocean. Don't worry, the technical hiccups are continuing. Christine has left us, but act cool and just pretend that it'll be fine.
I'll be back in a sec.
Yeah. So reefs are any sort of biological structure that are made by organisms in the sea.
I mean, right now it doesn't have to be biological because you do have artificial reefs. So oil ridges, for example, I think on the coast of California are now artificial reefs because they're not used anymore. And you can see that a lot of organisms have already occupied it. In the geological record, all we have are biological reefs, but at the moment you can also have artificial reefs that are made like from different man-made structure, or rather human-made structure.
Yeah.
Do people like sink ships?
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah, exactly.
They do that in the town where I'm from, there's a large naval base, and they decommissioned ships there. And they were trying to work out what to do with them. So they literally just gutted them, took all of the weapons out, all the fuel out, and they just towed them out to sea and sunk them and made big artificial reefs. And then now they take tourists out there.
Yeah. And then there's a major debate at the moment that some people say they shouldn't be there, but at the same time, they are like ecologically functional at the moment. So why should they not be there? Because what are you going to do with a sunken ship?
Mm.
Like there's no other place to put them in any case. So.
Yeah, and the interesting thing as well about that is that they rust and fall apart. And a lot of people think that that's really bad because it's like a type of pollutant. And I think, obviously, they have to be very careful because paints and things like that are pollutants. But just metal on its own isn't a pollutant because metal is just recycled naturally. That's what would happen to rocks that are full of iron. They would get dumped in the sea. And so, obviously, there's a lot of caveats, but...
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's super interesting. Okay, cool. So that's reefs. My next question was, what is a coral?
Oh dear.
Not such a good question.
Yeah.
It's an invertebrate.
Yes!
What is a coral? How do you define a coral, Emma?
I love how you pick up.
Oh, nice. I like that. The old switcheroo. Ah.
Oh.
You're on the spot now, vertebrate worker.
I believe a coral is a member of the animal family, so it is an animal, even though it might not look like it's alive, but it's actually a little colony of little animals, isn't it?
Mm.
And there's more
not
than
really.
One. Oh, not always.
You do have solitary corals that, so the ones like on the on the coast of Norway. So you do have like deep sea corals. They are like solitary, but can still like build big structures. But it's only the tropical ones usually that have colonies. And it's literally just a little bulb thing.
It's called a polyp. Right?
Yeah, polyp. Correct.
It's one of the best
And then they are the ones who kind of form the corallite. So that's the little cup in which the polyp lives, and then you have different ones living next to each other, and then the cups meet, then they make different colonies.
Yeah.
And then they eventually form corals.
They're crazy. I love corals. Corals are just so corals are basically like quite closely related to jellyfish. I think they belong to the same phylum, yep. Don't they? The Nidaria.
They do. Yeah.
And I love that like they have like obviously the I only know a lot about the tropical ones. And where they're all the little polyps like live in little colonies. But I love the fact that it's like sometimes in some corals, the little polyps will look after each other. So if a polyp is struggling, and it's like tentacles that it uses to catch food aren't working properly, the other polyps around it will pass it food, which is so cute.
That's adorable.
And it's like depending on the way they are connected as well, this helps to like communicate kind of in terms of like what's happening and things like that. But they are carnivores, and I don't know if you've ever seen a polyp try to catch something, but they have like they release this little harpoon thing that then tries to catch what I would assume is a plankton or something like that and then eat it. So
a characteristic of their group. So they belong to, as Thomas said, Nidaria, yeah. That they're actually like they're predators, and yeah. They have these nematocysts?
Nematocysts.
Yeah,
that's it. And they're like, well, they're not vicious, but you know,
they are
vicious.
They're crazy. They're crazy. So nematocysts are what jellyfish use to sting, basically. And yep.
They're deadly, I get it. But like, I'm thinking of like a little those little guys you get on the seashore that I absolutely love and whose name I completely forget.
Anemones.
They're so cute. They just like say hi. They just kind of kiss your finger with their deadly nematocysts.
I don't think they're kissing the planktons when they are trying to catch them.
They're pretty vivacious predators. I like, so for podcast listeners, Christine's connection may have dropped, and he just joined us when we were talking about things being harpooned, and he looked terrified. He was like, what is going on? I think his connection's probably gone again. So he just paused.
That's like we're talking about reefs.
He's literally got a permanent shocked look on his face. Anyway.
Oh dear.
This episode is it's cursed. It's cursed.
It's the black cats.
It's the black cats, yeah. Ugh, oh. Right. Where were we? No, corals.
Corals.
Oh, yes. And then my next question was, so in the news we hear a lot about coral bleaching, and that's like a really big threat. Can you walk us through what coral bleaching is and why it's important? Why should we care?
Well, coral bleaching, the easiest way to explain it is basically if you see a coral and it's completely white, it's bleach. So it's like basically the bleach that we use, I don't know, to clean stuff, for example. Hopefully not. The tropical corals usually live with symbionts called zooxanthellae.
You can't even
say it. So we're going to call them Z corals, okay? So the Z corals, they live together with these little algae that provide them with food. So they look after each other, basically. But when it gets too hot, the kind of immune system of the coral itself like tries to defend itself because things are not going great. So they kind of expel this symbiont. So, and the reason they become white is because they get the color from the algae. So if you look at the coral, you'd think like, you know, the color that a coral has, it's from like its own, but actually it's the algae. And when they expel it, what happens is like they can't really get food anymore. I mean, they can like hunt for them, like because they're carnivores, they can send their little harpoons. But they have adapted to rely more on this symbiosis relationship rather than looking for their own food, which is why it's bad for them. And the longer they go without the symbionts, the harder it is for them to feed themselves. And eventually, well, they're going to starve and they're going to die.
There's a trend of death here. Already.
Yeah, like we've got technical issues and bleak, horrific death.
But they can recover from it, basically. And the problem right now is the fact that bleaching really happens when the ocean temperatures really get hot. And usually this occurs like not throughout the year, but for a couple of weeks a year. Usually before you know, like it has always been heating up, but less than now. These used to happen every couple of years, which meant that the coral could recover before the next event. But what's happening now for the last few years is that this is happening very often, which means that before it can recover, it's getting hot again, and then it kind of goes into this crisis mode, which means that it's ongoing, which is why it's more of a problem now than before, because they're not recovering, because they don't have time to.
It might be jumping a little bit too far ahead, but can we see bleaching events in the fossil record, or is that something that we would need to see them in life to know?
I don't think we can. As far as I know, we are not able to do that. I mean, we can't even tell if they have this symbiotic relationship. Mm-hmm. All of this is inferred from living corals nowadays. So we think they had them, but we don't really know, because there's no really any preservation of that.
I guess in fossil corals, what you're seeing is the house that they've built, what they left behind, and not actually the little polyps that we were talking
exactly.
about.
Exactly.
Yeah, I was going to say that, because, so I don't know a super large amount about the fossil record of corals, but I think I remember learning that modern corals that have this symbiotic relationship have like a really weird fossil record, and we're not even sure how far back they go. And I think there's a few papers that suggest that they go back to the Triassic, but I don't think that's like, we're not sure, basically, is what I think is correct, but I could be wrong.
What do you mean by weird?
What do you mean? What did I say weird?
You did say weird.
Oh no, what did I say was weird?
The fossil record of the modern corals.
Oh yeah, so am I right? Is it only goes as far back as the Triassic, or is that my computer?
No, it is correct. So basically, before
Saber, you're killing me.
I'm over here.
Yeah, jeez, Louise.
So basically, before the Triassic, so before the end Permian mass extinction, which is about 200 million years ago. Or 250, I think, is it? Yeah. So you had like what we would call Paleozoic corals, and they were very different from what we have now. And they still build reefs, but a bit different. And then you had the Permian, Triassic extinction, which wiped them out completely. And then in the early Triassic, you don't get any corals. And then you start getting these Claractinian corals. These are the modern corals that appear. And then you get reef building again, and these have basically been like there since the Triassic. So if this is what you mean by weird, then yes, it is weird.
I don't know what I meant by weird. I don't even remember using the word weird. I'm sure if I listen, when I listen back to this, when I'm making the podcast, I'll be like, oh yeah, I did say the word weird. Oh, okay.
But basically it's very clear cut. Like you have the Paleozoic corals that got wiped out, and then afterwards you only get the modern corals.
Mm. Whoa. Fossil corals are sometimes, I think, the most common things that people will pick up and think, is that a fossil or is that just a rock? They're kind of, dare I say, like, I'm going to get killed for this, but are they? They're kind of boring, right?
What are you doing?
But they're like, sometimes you can see them on pavements, actually. So if you're walking around, particularly here in Birmingham, if you walk around the city centre, in the shopping centre, you can see some little rugose corals like embedded in the rock faces of the buildings. But that's kind of it, no? Prove me wrong.
I can't. You've probably seen more of them than me. They're like little blobs. Like, you don't see anything. What? Like,
I guess what's important here is the data that they can provide that allows us to think more about climate change.
So my supervisor has a lot of fossil corals in his office, and I work together with another student who just started her PhD. And then there was this rock, right? And I was like, what is this? I see nothing. It's basically, you know, like, and she was like, this is so interesting. I was like, okay, like, I don't see anything, you know?
I would totally do the same, but I think Chris will have us both for this.
I'm so sorry.
I mean, there is the classic thing that you need to, like, get your eye in to geology or paleontology. And it's just like, it just takes a bit of time. Just gotta keep looking at rocks, keep looking at fossils.
What are we missing out on then? I don't know if you work on corals specifically, Chris, but are we missing out on something really key from corals?
No, I mean, my knowledge of corals, you're asking entirely the wrong person. Okay. My knowledge is incredibly slim. I've written classic preparation for an episode, written a few notes, maybe questions and things I could ask. I've just written, why corals? Because no, nothing. I know very, very slim things about corals. Mm. I've missed... evidently I've missed parts of this chat already, so I don't even know what you've covered. Can't even ask anything about corals.
I just think, like, corals are one of those things where if you decide to go into paleontology and you decide to go through the sort of traditional route of earth science, maybe do a master's, I always think that corals, like, when they, you know, they plonk you down in the classroom and they just pop some things in front of you, and there's like a trilobite, and then there'll be like an ammonite, and then they'll pop, maybe if you're lucky, there'll be some sort of dinosaur bone or something, and then there'll just be like this thing that looks vaguely like corals that are alive today, and then someone will say, oh yeah, this is like 400 million years old, and you'll be like, great, and then that'll be it. And then you'll have to draw it, and the nightmare begins, because drawing corals is insanely difficult. And so it just, like, you can just see people just glaze over. But, like, I don't think people realize, like, how important corals are and how fundamental they've altered the ocean, and how crazy, like entire reef ecosystems are just... like the Great Barrier Reef, you know, like the Red Sea, like all of these places just rely so heavily on these corals. And also human beings, you know, the tourist industry especially, and also, you know, local indigenous peoples using it to get food. Like, it's such an important food source. I don't think people realize how important they actually are.
Well, I think there's a real issue that I know definitely exists. It's kind of along the vein of what we're talking about, in the fact that there aren't really many coral taxonomists left in paleontology, because unfortunately they are fairly boring pieces of rock. And they're really hard to identify. It's actually really, really difficult to tell apart corals. And it's really difficult to know what a different species of coral is because of these issues, because of the different types of coral, how do you identify them?
The interesting thing with that is that we can't actually compare. I think it's really hard to compare the modern taxonomy of corals to that of paleontology, because so what they found in modern corals is that they look the same, but like when they did some genetic analysis, they were completely different. So this is what we are calling like the cryptic species. So even the modern ones, like, you have all the data and it's really hard to like tell the taxonomy apart. And what we have with the fossil record is basically what's left, right? We can't even do any genetic analysis. So in terms of taxonomy, it's a complete mess.
Yeah. I think there's also another big problem in the kind of spatial distribution of corals and where they're kind of found, and how we're actually missing an enormous chunk of information, mostly from the kind of tropics, from the paleotropics, which is obviously one of the places where you'd be like, that's where you'd expect to see corals. And yet in general, there's an issue in terms of spatial sampling of corals, especially in the global south. And I don't know if we're too early to segue.
Did you just segue?
I've done.
We have so many questions in the chat about corals.
Oh, haven't said quite yet then. We'll just call it for a minute.
That's fine. I think, like, I don't even know where to start. So, I mean, like, so we've got questions like, Naseba, what's your favourite coral? Is very specific. Do you have a favourite coral?
Maybe. I don't have a favourite coral, but I do have a coral that I know, which is the Acropora, and that's the one that can basically be seen everywhere. Like, in modern oceans, this is the most successful coral. And it's the one that kind of grows like a tree. So it's basically like branching out. So you tend to see them everywhere. And then there's the brain coral that's just like the opposite of it, which is like a little blob just there. And I really like it as well. But I never thought that I don't have a favorite coral. Like, they're just a data point for me.
Well,
it's everywhere. Having a single tear roll down their cheek.
Yeah, that's answered that question. That's pretty intense. we've had other questions like, which reefs were more hardcore, coral reefs or rudest reefs? But I don't even know what that means. Like, hardcore in what context? Like, as in, like, liked headbanging? Or, I don't know. How do I even answer that question?
It's got to be rudests.
Yeah, rudests are pretty hardcore. Until they went extinct, and then they weren't hardcore anymore. So
well, maybe that answers
the
question.
I think that the, like, from what I'm told, because obviously I don't know a lot about them, is that the reefs that rudest build, yes, they are, like, you look at them and they're really pretty, but in terms of like size and stuff like that, they weren't really amazing, if that makes sense.
Amazing. some rugose coral reefs are massive though, like huge, like absolutely insane. Where was it? Was it in Amsterdam where all of the, I think all of the pavement slabs are from rocks that are full of rugose corals, and some of them are like big, like bigger than the entire pavement slabs. Like, they're absolutely massive. Yeah, I'm trying to think what other questions here. So this is an interesting question, and I don't know the answer to this question. Can you say whether tabulate corals were photosymbiotic, like modern reef corals?
So, as I said, we can't really infer that. So we don't even know if, whether they started with the symbiosis or they were solitary at first and then became colonial or became symbiotic. So I think there is evidence. There are some people who say they did have symbionts because of some sort of like things that they found or whatever. But we don't know, I think, is the answer. Well, actually, I don't know. So.
Yeah. I think that's the same with rugose corals as well. I don't think people are sure whether they're photosymbionts or whether they were active predators only. Yeah, weird. Okay, well, I think we've cleaned up some of the questions. So, Chris, would you like to move towards your next segue?
Well, so we were talking about spatial data points, issues with Global South and sampling. We've got a surprise for you lovely listeners. There's a second UpGur 5. Stunned silence from everyone on the chat. What's that? So yeah, Naseva, do you want to give us your second UpGur 5, pulling out all the stops for the end of season finale here?
Okay, so I hope it's not too controversial, but I'll give it a go. It has been checked by Emma before, so I think she would have told me if it was too controversial. Okay. Oh, dear. Once upon a time, there were some people who thought they were better than others. So they had a small meeting between themselves and decided things about the world. They told all the people what to do, took things from them, and killed many people. Fast forward a few hundred years later, they started fighting each other, lost many things, and said they would stop being so mean. But they didn't. They continued taking things from other people and telling them what to do, but they killed less people. Maybe. But now, the other people are speaking up and telling them that they can no longer continue doing what they have done for hundreds of years.
This book, Introduction to Colonialism and History.
Absolutely amazing. I've really enjoyed these all the stories. I think this is an absolutely excellent way to talk about your research and especially to introduce this topic. Naseb, do you want to kind of talk a little bit more about this and how it relates to some of the work that you and Emma have done together?
Exactly. So this is something that we started during the pandemic last year, when we got put together to do another article for the Paleontological Association newsletter. And we started talking, and then actually we were not out to like specifically looking at the colonial legacy or whatever within paleontology. We were just interested in languages. From languages, we went quite a long way, but I already had this like idea based on things that I had seen before of looking at how socioeconomic factors were impacting the way that we sample things, because I am a geographer. You could have introduced me as a geographer, actually. I tend to say that more often than a paleontologist. I never realized. Anyway, I'm used to like thinking about the human side of things too. And one thing, this is actually something that I missed when I started into paleontology, because it was like very much like focused on like the natural sciences and everything. And turns out Emma had been thinking about very similar things. So we just pulled our resources together, basically, and looked at data, which is something that we both do, and look at basically who is doing the research in paleontology and where these people are going to do research. And it's only after we collected this data that we saw these clear links where the like richer country researchers from richer countries rather were the ones doing most of the research. They were the ones not only in their countries but also going to other countries, some of them being like what we call the global south, so very low income countries, to do research, but without actually engaging any local paleontologists there. And then what happens is usually they go there, they do field work, they collect their data, I don't know, bring rocks home or something. And then it's only like at their local, at their home institution is where the dissemination of the data happens, and they write the papers, they get published, they become famous, blah, blah, blah. So this is basically what we saw. But one interesting thing that eventually we found is like we could see like very clear links with like between different countries that would go back to their colonial past. I think we picked up on France pretty early on. They're like, this is weird. We need to look into this. And this is literally how we found this link. Like we went up out to like call out people and, you know, say we should like investigate this, but this was so clear in the data that you know, you couldn't really refute it.
If we take a step back for a second, I think there's a really I think there's a fascinating fact that I always like to bring up. So I tend to work on fossil record bias. So yeah, these kind of biases in the fossil record. And obviously we talk about geological biases, so things that, you know, cause issues that are outside of our control. But we also talk about anthropogenic biases, biases caused by people. And this is always my favorite fact to bring out whenever I'm doing science communication, is that geography plays such an enormously important part of our understanding of paleontology. And it's no surprise that North America and Europe are the hotspots for fossils. If you go and look on the paleobiology database or any of these other kinds of large amalgamations of data, those are the places that you have all of your data points from, pretty much. And yeah, that's not because that's where the most fossils are by any stretch. That is where you've had people who've been in power for a long time, who've had money and resources and the stable political climate to be able to go and extract fossils and extract their information. And that is not uniformly true around the world by any stretch of the imagination. I think that this is kind of, we've been aware of that for a little while, but to have such clear links shown as you guys have done in your paper is kind of a different kind of kettle of fish. Do you want to tell us more about France? what have they done this time?
I mean, the France thing was actually a bug in the code. Eventually, But this is actually what got us on that path, basically. But what we do, so basically, if you would look like maybe in the 18th century or 19th century, you would see that Britain, for example, would go to where their colonies would be to do research, or France, the same thing. France, Germany is the same, lots of countries basically who have occupied and colonized other territories. You would see the same pattern. But what we do see in the data, that such links still exist, but now they just go everywhere they can, because they can. They have the money to literally like go where they want and do their research. So it was a good book.
Chris brought up a really good example of corals, that we should be looking for corals in the Paleotropics, so where the tropical regions were before like today's tropics. And we probably found out a lot more, and then it could feed into your research on climate change and how that's changing and how it's changed through time. But we don't, because they're in areas that only people with a certain amount of money and resources would be able to get to, right?
Yeah, and I think like we have a pretty good record, for example, maybe, I don't know, 200 years ago or something, because the tropics is actually what is now Europe or North America. So during that time, it would be good. But then as you get closer to modern times, when things, you know, things rotate and start moving, the tropics is no longer where the rich people are. They're actually like closer to where the countries that were actually occupied by the rich people. And this is something that we see also in modern corals as well, the fact that, you know, like most corals are found like in Indonesia, for example, but until recently, you didn't really have a lot of Indonesian researchers doing research there. And it's like, it's the same in Mauritius. I'm from Mauritius. We have corals there. And I can tell you, I had never thought before of studying corals. And I grew up next to them. Like, for us, they're normal, but it's not something that you do, because there are other people who come and do it for us.
I'm guessing they predominantly come from Europe and North America.
Definitely.
Documenting the patterns are one thing, and it's something that you very clearly enjoy because you're a data scientist. But I've noticed on Twitter that you've been mentioning about science diplomacy and things like that a little bit more. Is it possible to take, you know, these patterns that we're seeing and actually like bring them into policy, diplomacy, all that kind of stuff? Do you want to comment on that a little bit?
Well, yeah, so this is something that, you know, I've been into very recently. So I'm not someone who just likes documenting stuff. Like, it gets boring after a while. You know, like, unless you're going to use that data for something, I don't think there's really any worth to it. Like, So I started looking at like the ways of actually, you know, taking this data to actually make real changes. I don't know if I will be able to do that, but this is how I got into, I got into science diplomacy, kind of, which is like how, you know what a diplomat is. Basically, it's an attaché sent to another country and they help to make the relationship between countries better. But you can also do that using science. So you can, I hope you're not hearing what's happening over here.
There's technical difficulties in every aspect of this podcast today.
So the same can happen with science. Not like basically. I'm so sad.
Do we need to call an ambulance or?
No, I think everything's fine for now. But yeah, like, so for example, if you look at like astronomy or like even like the space station, you still have like this international space station, right? With people from different countries staying in one place, but you don't have like many places from which they can actually go from Earth to these places. So you do have to have like different contacts with between different countries to be able to get that going. So for example, the US might not like Russia, but for the sake of science, for example, and they will talk to each other. So it's the same about that. So this is like a tool that one can use to like help other sectors as well. And recently I've been like thinking of how our research actually can like bring the conversation towards like, for example, changing funding schemes. And because we've like what we see is something that is very systemic, and no matter how much, you know, like you as paleontologists, or even me as a paleontologist, would try to be better and try to engage try to work together with other people, we can only do that to a certain extent.
I love how you're talking about this like super serious, yeah, interesting, like deep topic, and it's just like chaos.
What is going on? I feel like people who aren't watching need to know what is happening right now.
So, my husband, tea.
Oh, okay.
Pretty long explanation. Yeah.
Does he not know who Paleo Pie is? What is this? This is an outrage.
But he did bring me a very interesting cup that I will show you as soon as my tea is brewed.
Oh my god.
Where was I?
International Space Station, diplomacy.
Oh yeah. So yeah, it's all systemic, and it's all because, you know, like we as researchers, you know, we have to publish, we have to like make our careers, become a professor, whatever. These are the things like we supposedly have to do, but at the expense of other people, because this is a very, like, the research or the system in which we do research is very individualistic. There's nothing, like, we are told we have to collaborate with each other and work together in teams or whatever, but at the end of the day, there's only one person who's going to be, like, the PI, like, the lead researcher on a project, or, you know, there's only going to be like one person who's going to be like first author on a publication. And this is because of the way the system is, but if we can change the system, it will ultimately make it better. But these conversations need to happen not just between us, but also with everyone, like from other countries, because research, like researchers nowadays, it's very transnational. Like I'm here sitting in Germany talking to you people who are in Britain, but and the same things happen like every day for many people. So why is it that you have to apply for funding in one country that would only benefit you, when you're working with so many people, some of whom might not even have funding to do anything? I mean, this work that we're doing, we are not funded to do this. We did this in our spare time. And there is a lot of people who do research full time without any such funding. And at the end of the day, what, they're gonna sit in the middle of a author list on of a paper or something and not get the credit for what they actually did, or even like not sit on that author list because people didn't think they were that important. Sorry, that was a bit deep.
A little bit. Okay, we've gotten used to it over this season. One thing that this really links to then, particularly with the speak of countries and how they communicate with each other, is international fossil law. Oh, that is a cute cup.
Is that a cat?
That's a llama.
That's a llama. Well, I think I've just failed biology. I was about to describe for our podcast listeners what's just happened, but I basically just thought a llama was a cat. So, well, let's move swiftly on. What were you saying, Emma?
Really good. International fossil laws, straight back into the hard stuff. There's been a lot of coverage recently, if anybody's tuned into paleo media or paleo news stories in the media. And that this has just really started to really come into the public's eye, and people are starting to question it and like raise a few eyebrows and stuff. But this is something that you look into as well, right?
So do you, Emma.
What a convenient segue. But I actually think this is super important, because a lot of what we've talked about affects particularly the academic world, but I think quite a lot of our listeners will be people who either are academics already, so know a lot of this stuff, or want to go into academia, so might be interested in these things. But I think that also quite a core group of our listeners are just fossil enthusiasts. And I think it's a really interesting and difficult conversation that we need to have at the moment, because like, hopefully you can tell us a little bit more about your work and stuff that you've been doing. But what's really interesting, I think, is some of the pushback that we've seen from those communities. Maybe we should talk about your research first, and then we can talk about like the sort of the wider implication and maybe how people actually interpret this kind of stuff. Because I think I like fueling the fire.
Okay, just like sprinkle some spice on there.
Yeah.
maybe to fuel the fire a bit more, I'm gonna say that not a lot of academics actually know about the fossil laws
that,
in the countries
that
in
is
which
also
they actually
very, very true.
Collect fossils. So that's a start. So basically what Emma and I, like just by coincidence, we started doing while we were collecting the data for this other project, we started seeing the country Myanmar popping up a lot while we were collecting the data. And I just found it odd because especially, so we have to explain how we did this work. So basically we downloaded all the references that are in the paleobiology database, and I think Chris is frozen again. And so
I
basically-
I thought you looked permanently surprised at what you were talking about.
I genuinely believe this episode is absolutely cursed. Like, oh my goodness.
And we looked at the last 30 years, so starting from 1990 and going on to 2020. And the way we divided the work was Emma would start with the 1990s and go up, and I would start from 2020 and go down. And in the middle, some people helped us, but most of the work was something that we did. But then, so I started like noticing that there was Myanmar popping up, and this wasn't happening for Emma, because the reason is, it's only in the last years that Myanmar amber became very popular within paleontology. Mm-hmm. And the research that around Myanmar amber really increased like exponentially, I would say, in the last years. And we were just, it was like this France thing, right? Something happened, we saw it, and we're like, okay, we need to look into this. And then around the same time, it was just a few months or weeks before that, the letter by SVP just came out. So that's the Society for the Paleontology. And
what is going on?
Well, Nassim is having a moment. I think I should jump in and say that the data we were collecting was who was publishing on what locations. We are consistently seeing that Myanmar was getting published, or fossils from Myanmar were being written about by researchers that weren't from Myanmar. And that throughout our data set, we didn't find a single person from Myanmar who was writing about the fossils from Myanmar, particularly those in amber. But for those that were primate fossils or other kinds of fossils, there were a few local co-authors, or local people from Myanmar.
Yeah.
And that was what set us off on this track.
And like, for context, for people who might not know about Myanmar, Myanmar amber is particularly famous because basically the amber was forming around the time of the dinosaurs. So there are dinosaur remains preserved in some of these amber things, and they have received huge amounts of press, And some of the fossils are incredibly spectacular, but there's a very dark side to Myanmar and why Myanmar amber is so problematic. Do you want to talk a little bit about why Myanmar amber is so problematic?
No, this is why Nassim is here. I'm just here as a question person.
I know, but I thought Nassim was still having technical difficulties, so I was trying to keep the segue. Oh my, I'm just going to leave.
I was having feline difficulties. I can go on. So basically Myanmar amber is found in a very specific place in Myanmar, and that's in the north of the country. That's in the state of Kachin, or Kachinland, as the locals call it. So the Kachin people, are the ones who live there, and they've been in conflict with the Myanmar government, who are like, whether it's the military or like the civilian government recently, but more the military, because that's like more the history. And they've been like fighting since the British left the country, and the country became independent. And that's because they want to be autonomous. But this is where the all the resources, all the natural resources of the country, well, not all, but most of them, like, you have ruby, you have jade, you have amber, so all the precious gems are located in that state. And Myanmar amber is actually mined from one of the mines, well, one of the regions there. They found other mines in other places that are not in Kachin, but I think the most productive ones are still in the north of the country. So there's already this conflict going on, but I think 4 years ago now, the military decided that they wanted to control the mines there, because, so when we're talking about control of the mines, so they not only took control of the amber mines, but also of the jade mines as well. And that's only after like the civilian government came into place, and like they kind of allowed also the like, before it was only artisanal mining, but then afterwards they allowed like larger companies to come and like start mining, so that they would make more money. And a lot of these companies were already like connected to the military, and what they were doing then is like driving these people away. But there's also like reports of sexual abuses and what would be equivalent to genocide going in there in that location. And this is all related to amber mining. And most of the amber that is coming out, it's really hard to tell in which condition they were mined. So either they were mined by the local people who have to rely on mining to make a living, because they don't have any other options in the country in terms of economic, there's so much economic problems, basically. But it is technically illegal for them to mine these unless you have a proper permit. So what happens is usually they would go after hours and mine this amber at the risk of being killed by the military. Now you have the military that is legally mining this amber out, but also like there's all these human rights abuses happening there, and there is this connection to that. And then there's also like people who would sell this amber, but because of tax reasons, what they do is that they actually smuggle it out into China, where the Kachin military, so that's the Kachin Independence Army, make most of their money, directly funds the war, the conflict with the military. And this is very complex. that actually funds the war with the military themselves, because they also have something to gain from the war. So I'm not saying like, you know, only the military is bad, because they're also fueling conflicts. And a lot of money that comes from gems, so not just amber, basically goes into like funding the war rather than providing people with the basic necessities. So this gets smuggled in China, where you can access amber. And then what these people do is like to actually launder their money. They keep some of the amber or gems with them to actually sell them at these governmental emporiums, where you can legally obtain your amber. But these governmental emporiums also connected to the military, which who is the ones who get the money. So in any way, I don't know how you would get your amber, but it's really hard to find, I would say, to find amber that is unconnected to all these issues that I have just mentioned. And this is what makes it super complex, the situation, but also why one should be cautious if you are an amber worker.
I guess to me, who's working in this area, it's a no-brainer to me to stop working on contentious stuff. Just stop. Like, there's
we forgot to mention the legal issues of fossil versus amber. Oh no.
Thanks. basically, it's very hard to get amber from Myanmar that is above board, completely ethical and sound. Everything, there's so many connections there that it can be an illegal, ethical, humanity, just don't do it. But yet there are so many people who work on this amber, and it gets a lot of press, and it's astounding.
It's something that all paleontologists should, and just all people really, should be aware of. And I mean, thankfully, there has been a greater push in the last couple of years, and some larger science kind of news places, I think New Scientist and Nature, and I think Science.
All of the outlets.
All of the major outlets have thankfully started writing articles about this. And I think the New Yorker as well, or the New York Times. So it is gaining more attention, but there is still, it's not even a debate. It's just people who want to work on this material.
Yeah.
And I think, frankly, like for the most, I mean, and you know, I'm saying this with like many caveats, but for the most time, people who, you know, research and for paleontology, you're not really affecting many people. There's obviously, like, you know, as we said, if you're doing parachute science, or if you're going to a place and extracting information and not, you know, thinking about the local people there, or if you're ignoring colonial history in a place that you work, yes, those are issues, but those are issues that are faced by everyone, like, you know, researcher or not. But to make the active choice to work on material that is so clearly and directly related to human suffering, I think as a paleontologist is just inexcusable. There are things that are more important than fossils, unfortunately. And yeah, I think it's a really, really valuable thing what you guys have been doing in terms of raising awareness about this, in terms of researching it and finding out the kind of broader publication pathways and linkages that go with it, because it is an issue that should be seen by everyone in the scientific community and the broader civilian community as well.
Community.
Lost it a little bit at the end there. It's my impassioned speech.
Civilian community. Derailed. Like it's a super important topic, and it's something which I'm really glad that we're talking about on the podcast. I think, you know, we've touched on colonialism a few times in some of the other talks. I know Franz brought up things about how, so we talked about parachute science, which is where scientists drop into a country, you know, take what they want, don't help anyone else out, don't bring anyone up with them, you know, things. I think paleontology is such a unique science. I'm sure there are other people could write in the chat or whatever, or listening to the podcast will think, oh yeah, that happens in other sciences too, but paleontology is such an interesting and unique case with ethics, because it's so difficult, there are so many things that we should be thinking about. Who owns the land? Who originally owned the land? Who did we steal the land off? Where the fossils come from? Are fossils something which belong to everyone, or do they belong to the person who found them? And then on top of that, we have all these other huge questions, like the intrinsic value of fossils. Like, people will pay millions and millions of dollars for, you know, T-Rex skeletons, which starts to make ethics of extracting T-Rex skeletons incredibly shady. And Myanmar amber is like the perfect personification of that, I think, in like the perfect storm, in that they gain huge amounts of scientific interest. And because of that, they get a huge amount of public interest. And because of that, they are inherently expensive, because also amber is a precious stone. And then gemstone, precious stone. Is that not the right word? Anyway, it's a gemstone. So it has an intrinsic value anyway. And then when you start adding inclusions, like the fossils themselves, they become even more valuable. And then on top of that, that value is funding like genocides. Yeah, it's super horrific, and it makes me super sad, if I'm brutally honest, when I read about it. Like, really hurts to, like, you know, when I go to speak to kids at school and they talk about dinosaurs and they're super hyped and all of this stuff, and then they ask me about a dinosaur or something which is described from amber, Myanmar amber in particular, like, I'm genuinely like torn, because yes, it's a cool sample, but also, like, you don't know how much human suffering was caused from, you know, extracting that Yeah, and it's pretty rough.
I mean, when you think about it, this is what we know, but how much of it do we not know? Like, there are a lot of fossils found in a lot of places, and Myanmar Amber came to light basically because it's so popular, right? And because of the specific, like, super good preservation, but also because of the fact that it's like around the time that the dinosaur lived, and we can actually know what maybe they were doing at the time, whatever. But there are other places where we don't actually know what's happening because they're not getting this level of media coverage. But I don't think like it's a single case. I don't think like Myanmar Amber is the only issue when we talk about these things. It's just that we don't know what is happening around the world with regards to fossils. Because when you talk about fossils, you think like, oh, they've been dead for so long. They have no connection to humans. But then you have like all these Jurassic Park movies or whatever that provide paleontology with like really good press, which actually make them connect, like it's connected to popular culture. It is something that is embedded like in our culture nowadays, and everyone knows about dinosaurs, and that is what makes it valuable. And I don't know why we don't see that. Or like we don't think about ethics when it comes to that. Like when I did my bachelor thesis was on a simulation, okay? So it was completely theoretical, and I still had to complete an ethics form, a complete one, and submit it, and had to have it approved before I could start my bachelor thesis. But I've never had to do that since, because in paleontology, it's not something that is considered important. But this is, knowing what we know right now, I think this is something that we do have to start considering, like ethic checks. It's not just another form, like people will complain probably that it's like other paperwork that they have to do. But this actually is a start maybe to actually providing you with like food for thought, basically. It's like when you're ticking these boxes, it will make you think, like things like dealing with human rights abuses or what, or political conflicts. It's not going to be afterthought when you're like publishing, and then this publisher or this journal is not going to accept your fossil, and you're like, oh no, I should have thought about this. Or what is the journal that is going to allow me to do this without asking me too many questions? But like it shouldn't be an afterthought, basically. Even if you're working with these things, these are things you should consider before, and how to deal with, how to mitigate these. Whether or not you should actually be doing this. I mean, for some people it's hard because there may be PhD students who are stuck doing the stuff that they are, or it's really hard for people to retrain, especially in like when you've worked on taxonomy or something really specific. So it's going to take time, I think, for people to like move from this to other stuff. But at the same time, there's so much stuff in museums. Just go there and get your Amber rather than getting new ones.
I was going to say, this links quite nicely onto a little question that I thought I would ask somewhere towards the end of this this show. At the very beginning, you said, okay, well, we've moved now, you know, in your other research, you've moved from looking at extinctions to looking at survivors. And so I'm going to turn the same question from a negative to a positive. I'm going to ask you, what are the steps forwards? Like, what can we do as individual paleontologists or as individual people? And what do you think we as collective paleontologists have to do as a field to kind of move things forwards? Do you have any suggestions?
Should read our paper.
Step one.
Hit the paper hard.
But basically, these are things that we should be thinking about. So, as students, we should be taught about these things. So if we are a field work, like a field-based focused field, but we are never taught, or at least I wasn't when I did my bachelor's and master's, like to think where I would be going about the local culture, but also about the laws that we, you know, like that is related to what we were doing there, whether we're collecting. Like I was collecting like dirt, those are not even rock, but anyway, or like fossils, like are there any laws, are there anything that we have to think about before even going there? Like we have to have this talk with students Because if you're not training to that, it's really hard later on while you're doing to actually develop this, because it's like we've been brainwashed to think in a way, and then you kind of have to change completely the way you think. And this is harder than if, you know, while you're starting out, these are things that you're told. Just like we're told to, like, you know, we work with data and we're told, like, okay, you should take care of sampling bias, for example. This is something that everyone knows, everyone who works with fossil data knows that they have to do. So this should be as natural to think about, like, fossil laws and ethics. And as individuals, like, if you're starting, if you know you're going somewhere and to do something, like, do get in contact with local scientists, because most likely they know more than you. You just don't know that they know more than you. And because, for example, if you go somewhere where English is not the main language of science, you might have had a lot of things already written in other languages that you might not be able to read. But if you do engage with them, you will know about this, because, like, students do a lot of small projects, and these projects end up, like, maybe in the thesis or dissertations, or maybe they end up in the local university journal, for example. So these might not be online, so you don't know about it. And so do get in contact with local people. But if you say, okay, there is no local scientist that that I can contact there, ask yourself why, right? There is a reason why. If you are going to a place where you know there are fossils, why would there be no single paleontologist there? So maybe you might want to, like, get in contact with, like, the local universities. If you're doing research there, you might want to talk about your research so that people actually know what's there or what you're doing. You know, don't just go and then come back without, like, doing anything to actually, like, communicate about your science, is what I'm saying, and collaborate with people. But I, as I said before, I don't think this is something that we can do individually, because there are limits to what we can do. It really has to be, like, the system changing and adopting new ways of doing research, because right now we are pushed to do research in one way, and unless this changes, the practices that we currently have are not going to change.
Yeah, I think that's it, isn't it? I mean, we may not be able to individually change it, but if we all individually act, then eventually the systems will change. Yeah. Oh man, and I will say as well that the other thing as well, on a positive note, is this isn't like if you're just working on something which is super problematic, like Myanmar Amber. So my PhD was based in America, in Illinois, and I never considered any of this. I just went over there, collected some fossils, great, you know, checked with the landowners who, like, own the farms, whatever, collected fossils and left. And it wasn't until afterwards, when I, you know, started to read about this kind of stuff, that I was like, okay, well, yeah, I checked with the landowners, but I didn't check with the people who, like, were removed off the land. And it was, what was super interesting for me as well, is that, like, the fossils that I work on, they've been known, inverted commas, known about since the 1800s by white explorers. But they were known long before that by the, you know, the indigenous peoples who used them in sort of rituals and worshipped and medicinal properties and all sorts of things. And that's just completely removed out of the history. So, you know, even when you're working in somewhere like North America, you can still, you know, still this kind of stuff is really important. Read about it, you know, see what you can do, make a change. Yeah. Wow.
And you brought up something really interesting, because a lot of people who have issues with laws tend to think, like, oh no, these laws are stopping me from getting these fossils from basically these low-income countries that we talked about. But, and you know, like, they stop science, they are a barrier to science or whatever. But what they don't realize is, like, we have very similar laws in the rich countries as well, so that they're so used to, like, doing this paperwork that they don't, like, think about them. It's just, like, for these other countries that they have an issue, because, like, it might be none of the language, like, or you know, they don't know the system, or they're like, oh, you know, like, these laws are not important, they're not going to do anything to me, so I might as well just go and get it.
Yeah, I won't name names for libel reasons, but
I think everyone knows.
But I've seen literally people who are, you know, paleontologists who have broken laws, but yeah, have given talks at about SSSIs in the UK and how we must protect the geological heritage of the UK. I'm like, you can't have it both ways. Anyway, before we get in legal trouble, we've been with technical issues, we've been going on and on and on. But Naseba, this has been super interesting. Thank you so much for giving us your time. I guess this is the end of season two. We're not going to be back next week, but we will be back in the near future. We've got some fun things planned coming up. We're going to take a little bit of time off, but we've got some really cool stuff that we're going to do. Our website will be up to date, and keep an eye on it. If you want to listen to us, you can find us pretty much on any podcast place, as per usual. And I'm going to end with, you know, thank you again, Naseba, for taking the time to
thank you
to
chat for having
us.
Me.
You can follow Naseba on Twitter at Mauritian Tales, and she also has her own podcast, which is Paleo Pickles, which is spelt the British way. And if you search Paleo Pickles, it's like the first thing you'll find on Google. So make sure you check them out. And with that, we hope you'll join us again for future paleo parties. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you, Emma and Chris.
Thank you.
It's been great.
Bye.
See you soon.
See you soon, guys. I'm going to go get a cup of tea. See you later.
But do you have a llama cup?
Oh, yeah. I thought it was a cat. Sorry. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.